Hello, and welcome to the In Good Faith podcast, where two friends talk about society and culture through a Christian lens and in good faith. That is, we approach everything with charity and curiosity, and we aim to help our listeners do the same. My name is Chong, and with me on the other line is Dan Shi. How's it going, Dan?
I'm well, thanks. I'm doing pretty well. It's a couple of days left till the end of the year, and I've got a nice tan. Very, very, very full of Christmas ham, and with at the 11th hour, sneaking in just at the finish line, it looks like we're going to get in another episode before 2024 is upon us.
Yes, by popular request and demand, we will satisfy our audience with another episode.
Yes, that's right. And we just saw each other yesterday, didn't we? We had our annual families get together, had all six of the kids running around, had a bit of a swim and everything.
Yeah, it seems like a bit of a pattern now. It's like we see each other and then we podcast, which is nice.
We see each other and then we feel guilty because our faces remind each other that we have outstanding work to do. And then we podcast.
Unfinished business.
Yeah.
All right, shall we get into it?
Yeah, sounds good. I thought that, this being an end of the year episode, it might be nice to sort of talk a bit about 2023 reflections and how did you overall feel about it and all that sort of thing. How would you rate your 2023 with like one or two words or a phrase or a thumbs up or a thumbs down?
Oh, okay. So when I talk to people and just kind of talk about how we're going or our year, I just use the word full. It was very full, right? In terms of my time, on my energy, on my schedule and on my energy levels, it's kind of just like everything was very packed.
Yeah, I feel like I know what you're saying, and I kind of want to say that full sort of sounds like a euphemism for something else that we probably say way too often, which is busy. Am I right in saying that?
Yes, that's very pastorally insightful of you, Dan.
Caught red-handed, that's right. Yeah, no, I totally get that. I feel the same way, too. It's just been so busy. Honestly, I feel like I would take it one step further. For me, 2023 didn't just feel busy. It felt chaotic. It just felt... There was almost like an extra sense of, are things even in control? Like, do I even know what I'm doing with my life? What's going on? And... what's going to happen tomorrow, next week, next year, and stuff like that. And honestly, I'm just wondering if our listeners feel the same. Like, do we feel like things are not just busy, but quite chaotic? And I want to say that if you feel that way, you feel that the world around you is more chaotic, more fast-paced, less ordered, more uncertain than before, definitely you're not alone. And I might even say you're not imagining it. And I'll just tell you, like, for me personally, I was wondering about this. Like, I was wondering, am I just imagining this? And for a while, I made up excuses. Like, it's still just, it's post-COVID. We're still returning back to normal and everything. And, I'm in a pretty chaotic stage of life right now. And that's the reason why. So I don't want to, I don't want to project. But the truth is that it's not just me. And it's not just... what's going on with my life and Dan's world. It's our world. And so I guess to lead off, like, where is all this craziness and chaos coming from? In what ways are we kind of experiencing a little bit more of an uncertain world?
Yes, I feel like you were asking a very leading question about how our year was. I feel like this is the direction we're going. So, yes, Dan.
That's right. Yeah, so I guess... I think I can sort of maybe break it down into three ways. So three ways in which I feel like we are entering some crazy years. Or we can say this is a pivotal moment. Like something tectonic is changing. Like the ground underneath us is shifting in a way.
And it's obvious and apparent to us.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not just a perception thing. It's real and material. So the first... thing you can point to is you can say social or technological. So there's a sense of technology almost speeding up. And for me, the moment that like I was kind of awoken to this feeling or to this fact is about how fast tech is moving and how close it is or how risky it is and how close we are to getting it out of control is, funny enough, something that I use almost every day, and that's ChatGPT. Like, I think we talked about this before. We had an entire episode about AI, or at least about what do you call it? LLM.
Large language models.
Yes, that's right. But you know, AI is upon us, like in a very real way. And you can say yes, it's limited. It's just a speech thing. It's just a language software thing. But no, like it feels that way. And I think that it really does indicate that, like, time is, like, that tech is speeding up. Like, just as an example, so humanity 5 millennia ago was using bronze. Like, that was, like, the technology du jour. And it took us 2,000 years to get us from bronze to iron, just to make that jump. And when we finally discovered...
From one kind of metal to another kind of metal, a more effective kind of metal.
A superior metal, which did a lot better things, and iron swords beat out bronze swords on the battlefield all the time, and that's just the start. But it was such a slow process, and then we stuck with iron for ages, right? But here's a fact, and you might have heard this floating around in the internet, but from the time between the Orville brothers inventing and producing the first airplane to the moment that we as a species landed on the moon... How many years was that, if you can guess? It was 66 years. So from the moment we invented flight to the moment that we flew to the moon was just barely over half a century.
Within, like, one person's lifetime, right?
Yeah, like that's too fast, right? And what does that do to, like, our psyche, to our mindset, to our society, right? And yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and I guess... 66 years sounds like a long time, but now it's kind of like we're living in the age of, well, smartphones was, you know, barely over 10 years ago, right? Kind of the widespread adoption with social media and all that kind of stuff, and now we're the AI age is upon us. I actually read through this interesting summary of technological breakthroughs in The Atlantic, right? The writer Derek Thompson. And he's kind of summarizes a few other things that I think are worth mentioning, just to indicate that we are sort of in a quite a revolutionary age, right? So have you heard of the technology CRISPR? So C-R-I-S-P-E-R.
Yes.
And so it kind of stands for this long, very long chain of words that I don't know how to pronounce. But basically it's the idea that it's a technology that can be used to edit genes, right? So we can... go in within living cells, right, and actually be able to, like, turn off, like, edit stuff, right, to actually treat genetic diseases now, right, which is pretty crazy. And so the FDA has actually approved the first medicine based on CRISPR technology, right, to treat sickle cell disease. And so we're getting to the point where and the FDA is not some revolutionary body, right? They're very slow moving, cautious, conservative, right? They've approved this drug. And so, but, you know, we are now on the beginning of the road to gene editing, right? Becoming legitimate kind of medicine, right? Yep. And you know that movie Gattaca about, you know, sort of, using DNA kind of selection, right? To create superior human beings and all that kind of stuff. That is the road to Gattaca, right? We're on that road now. There's this whole thing around, weight loss drugs at the moment, you know, like Ozempic, I think, is one, right? It's treating type 2 diabetes, but also used for weight loss. And the interesting thing there is it's not just about weight loss, but it seems to sort of, like, affect just people's kind of addictive behaviors, right? So it seems to kind of affect smoking for smoking addicts, gambling for gambling addicts. And so, like, it's a drug that's kind of affecting our gut, but also our mind, also our willpower, right? And it's like, okay, so what would that do, you know, to the human population, right? that now that it's sort of in a thing. Obviously, we talked about like ChatGPT and LLMs, right? Yeah. And so if LLMs is kind of like, you know, taking the whole sort of corpus of human knowledge, right, and sort of putting it all in a big sort of soup, you know, to then like get the, you know, different kinds of formulas and ingredients out of it, right, to make mm-hmm. meaning out of it. Well, you can apply that to the medical realm, right, to, again, back to genetics, like, DNA and genes are just a kind of language, right? And so if we can sort of like feed that into this kind of AI technology, right, which scientists are now doing, you know, we can be able to like predict protein sequences and all that kind of stuff, right? So it's kind of like using AI to decode biology, right, down to the atomic level. So so what can we do then to sort of reshape it, mold it, you know, change it, right, to how we want to be, right? Or just, yeah, it's kind of like, again, this whole concept of like playing God, right? Like what can we able to do is just, yeah, quite amazing.
So I think out of all this, the point that we're trying to make is not that there is new technology. I mean, because there's always been new technology. Mm. It's the pace at which it's happening. So I think that's the disorienting part, the part that gives you like this sense of vertigo in life. It's because with every new innovation, life changes, right? Like when we discovered flight, the way that humans travel changed to sort of accommodate that. But now it feels like every few months or so, there's a new innovation or breakthrough that's changing life, and it never gives you a chance to settle and feel settled for a little bit. And so I think along with this, there's also a fear that technology isn't always driven to improve human life and to make us flourish and to stay on topic, to give us peace. In fact, like, where is all this going? Like, what is the why of technology? What drives it? It's not necessarily to make humanity flourish. I mean, that's the conceit. That's what we're hoping. But that is that always how it always turns out? And so just as an example, to pull in another thing we've talked about before, it seems like what a lot of new technology in the last few decades has in common is that it's driven towards disembedding and disembodiment. So that's a one of our favorite phrases that you and I have been throwing around a lot, Chong, right? Because we say that to be a human means to be embodied, like to be physical, we have a body, and to be embedded in the sense of being in a community, in a social network, right?
Yep.
And what has tech done? Like, so 2004, Facebook transformed how we use the internet. And the original vision, which was a beautiful vision, was to have a global community where your friends didn't have to just be the people that, you know, you would see, like your neighbors and people who live in your town. You could be friends with people across the globe. So it disembedded you. Your social network was no longer limited to, you know, the traditional things like family and local community. And disembodiment, so like most of the stuff that we just talked about, from AI to even simple things like how fast like smartphones are changing the way we interact with each other and all that kind of thing. It's about us extending our physical selves with the digital, right? So phones are as much a part of us now. We've talked about this. Like my smartphone is my brain. It's my personal assistant. It's my communication. It's my vocal box. It's, I talk to people through it, et cetera, et cetera. And so if so much of technology is removing us from who we are, like, is there any wonder
that... In an embodied way.
Yeah. Is there any wonder that we feel chaotic, or we feel that the world is chaotic, right? And I'll just take it one step further. And I'm not going to beat on too long about this, Chong, because it's, you know, we'll go on too long. But talking about what drives technological innovation, I'm worried that it's actually driven by our economic system, i.e., and I hate to sound, I hate to say this, I really do, but you know, capitalism, right? Like, and what is that? It's the almighty dollar, right? And so it's how can, what does tech do? How does tech improve our lives? That's the wrong question. The question should be, how does tech help us to monetize? And too often the answer is that it dehumanizes.
Yeah, and this is like very fertile ground for, I think, like a future episode, right? And, you know, and we've talked about this, you know, we've read like Paul Kingsnorth, where he talks about the machine, right? Where it's like technology is kind of like a perfect match for the capitalist system, right? Yeah. They kind of go hand in hand to sort of commoditize and dehumanize and, you know, sort of, yeah, like turn everything into liquid modernity, right? So let's park that, but yeah, but definitely, you know, we're calling that out. I think just quickly with the other stuff that we want to mention, right, like the spheres in which it just feels things are accelerating. So one, you know, one of our sort of pet things that we always go to, like the end of history idea, right? Geopolitics, right? I think like we did an episode sort of at the start of the Russia-Ukraine war, right? And I think it's still going, right? Yeah. And if anything, like things are sort of getting worse in terms of like small-scale conflicts elsewhere, right?
Yep.
And you know, it's just another indication of the crack-up, right, of Pax Americana, right? The idea that, you know, America was the hegemon, right? They sort of are the world police, right?
Yeah.
The world was unipolar. And they kind of kept the peace, right, for, you know, for better and worse. But now that they're sort of like, you know, retreating a bit, you know, they're sort of losing influence, when there isn't that sort of one big gorilla, right, then all the smaller players start to, you know, sort of fight amongst themselves, right? So, you know, there's like conflict right now between Armenia and Azerbaijan. I think it's kind of quieted down a bit, but you know, so there's that. There's like multiple countries in Africa right now. You know, it's out of the news because it's like Africa, right? It's just, you know, the way I would put it. But you know, in terms of the number of people like dying and being displaced, you know, actually much greater than the Middle East, right? Than Israel, Gaza, but it's just, you know, not in the news. And then in terms of China, especially, right? And what's going to happen with Taiwan, and what, you know, is President Xi Jinping going to do? Like, he recently visited the US as part of the APEC summit, right? You know, had a meeting with Biden and all that.
Yeah.
And pretty much it's like, you know, Biden's kind of talking about the traditional, you know, America stands by the two, is it the two states or like whatever the, you know, the formulation is, right?
Yep. Two-state solution.
Keeping the status quo on Taiwan. And she's pretty much just like, well, yeah, like, peace is all well and good, but at some time, we need to resolve this issue, right?
Yeah.
And he's going to reserve the right to use force, you know? So that is all still simmering, right? But we can see, like, the crack-ups sort of continue to happen. And then, Dan, do you want to talk about the third piece of it?
Yep. So we're talking about three ways in which the world is more chaotic and makes you feel less peace, right? So one is the technological, the other is the geopolitical, and then the third one is the one we're going to spend kind of the rest of the episode unpacking a little bit more, and that's the personal. So I'm probably not the only one to notice that lately, and I would say maybe in the last few decades, there's a growing awareness and acceptance of disorder within the heart. And what I mean by that is simply that things like mental illness and mental health is now being normalized where it was once stigmatized. And if you didn't notice this, it's probably because it's happened so quickly that you thought that we'd always talked about mental health this way. You know, like, you hear about companies giving you, you know, your personal leave, your sickness or carer's leave, and then mental health days on top of that. Like, that's becoming more regular and routine. Talking about trauma, like, trauma is a buzzword now. It has been throughout the 2010s. It's in vogue. And, you know, obviously, while not all talk and, you know, discussion around the idea of trauma, you know, things like, oh, you know, like childhood abuse and PTSD and domestic violence and stuff like that, or you know, untreated mental health disorders or stigma against the neuroatypical. So, you know, like people with ADSD and stuff. ADHD.
ASD.
And ASD. Yeah. That's right. Like not fitting in, and then society stigmatizing them and relegating them to the margins. And there's more and more awareness that of we have to do better, and we will do better, and we're going to work to do better, right? And so, of course, not all of it is helpful, but a growing awareness of trauma and its deleterious effects on the human soul, and the way that impedes our ability to live our best lives. Like, that's a good thing. That's happening. And so I think there's two ways to look at it, right? So why is it there more awareness of mental health issues and lack of peace in the heart? So one way to look at it is that like people are softer than before, you know, like the boomer back in my day, like we just swallowed our feelings and, you know, like, and you know, there's a bit of truth to that. I think there is truth to that, right? So Jonathan Haidt, the social psychologist out of the States, he's been doing a lot of great research on this. And one of the things that his groundbreaking book, The Coddling of the American Mind, right? He says that individual resilience is in decline. And he spends a lot of time looking at American college students. But I think what he finds can be extrapolated out through society in general. And he talks about how social media and smartphones, so once again, technology is impacting us in a negative way, making us less resilient, making us more mentally fragile and all that sort of thing. But another way to look at it is that we're finally aware of what's always existed, right? So it's not like there weren't neuroatypical people in the 1800s, or there wasn't depression, anxiety, or, you know, or we didn't have mental health needs as human beings. But, you know, there was always trauma and toxic relationships and all that. But now we finally have the categories and concepts and terminology to describe it. And
yes, well, so if I can take that a bit further, right?
Yeah.
And going back to like, why does it feel different now, or accelerated or whatever now, is that trauma and mental illness or mental health has become content, right? Like it has been caught up. So it's not just, oh yeah, people are more aware and there's more acceptance of it, right? But in a negative way, it's been kind of sucked up by, you know, the forces of our age, right? You know, back to like capitalism, you know, this idea of like the attention economy, right? Where on social media, right, on TikTok, on YouTube, whatever, people are sort of like talking about, you know, displaying all these mental health stuff, right? And that gets the attention, right? And so it's kind of like it's normalizing, you know, or kind of making it a status symbol, right? That, you know, so-and-so is suffering from something, right? And they want to talk about it, you know? And it's actually like, you know, from my perspective and, you know, like my background doing psych and working with young people and stuff, it's not a good thing that, like, it is being, like, yeah, the pendulum has swung too far, right?
Yeah.
We've gone from not talking about enough to like talking about it too much, right? So there's these researchers who coined the term prevalence inflation, right? So especially young people, they consume so much information about anxiety disorders that they begin to process normal problems of living as signs of a decline in mental health, right?
Yeah.
So these you know, psychology researchers, and so yeah, it's a big problem where anxiety or trauma, or, you know, various kinds of mental ill health, right, gets wrapped up in someone's identity, right? And then that identity is displayed online. It gets clicks and attention and affirmation, you know, and it becomes, you know, it's monetized and so forth, right? And it's a problem, you know? And I think that's, yeah.
And let's not skip over, like, what you basically just said, like, let's like take a second to note how perverse that is, right? So it's you're basically saying someone, an individual with mental health issues, makes that their identity and then commodifies themselves and turns themselves into a product for attention or clicks And so it's like, it's so twisted, like how many layers it is, right? Like,
yes.
like you said, it's sucked up. It's mental health awareness and our growing understanding of it, which is a good thing, but then becoming twisted when it collides with the zeitgeist, with the forces of our age, capitalism and identity politics. And then that's when you get people who fake disorders or exaggerate disorders and then, you know, become like Instagram influencers, and then that's their shtick, you know, that's their gimmick.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's going to be like a theme of what we're going to talk about today, right? You know, it's a bit all over the place, but I think it is like, it's both big and small in its scope, right? In terms of like the disorder that we feel, right? The pace of change, the absence of peace, right? And that, you know, we feel it at an individual level, but that is like downstream of the socio-technological and the geopolitical kind of developments, right? But then there's like this interaction effect where the way that, you know, we communicate, we receive information, that we experience reality, right? And therefore, then we act back into the world, right? That then impacts everything else. But, you know, to kind of wrap our arms around it a bit more, we're going to focus on that individual element, right? So like a person experiencing peace or a lack thereof, right? Which is what we're going to talk about in the next part of the show. All right, coming back. So Dan, you've mentioned the P word, peace, right? A few times, you know, in the introduction. And I guess, you know, the way to think about it is we've talked about chaos, we've talked about disorder, right? So the opposite of that, right? Or the antidote to that is peace. But I think it's a deceptively complex, you know, a tricky word, right? To sort of, to understand, to define. And I think like even in our preparation, right, for this episode, it was like, oh wow, you know, there's actually a lot of different ways to kind of approach this. So I'm just going to kind of throw out some common understandings, right, of sure, what peace is, right? We just kind of riff on that, you know, give some personal examples, and then we'll kind of try to land on, you know, a more satisfying definition at the end. Okay, so
sounds good.
What do we mean by peace? So one way to sort of look at it is, it's the absence of bad stuff, right? So we have peace if we are free from stuff like negativity, anxiety, worry, stress, right? So examples could be, we're not under financial stress, right? Or constantly being worried about money. You know, that's, you know, quite important in terms of feeling at peace. Another one is just more direct, you know, an upcoming work deadline, right? Or just you know, having the feeling that, oh, like, I'm not going to make it. You know, like, I'm running out of time. Obviously, you know, that kind of detracts from peace. And, you know, and speaking of all that mental health stuff, right, previously, yeah, it's, you know, when we are persistently just in a negative mood, we feel inadequate, we're sort of worried about what other people think of us, right? And it could be triggered by a situation, an event, something we saw on social media, right? That can all kind of contribute to like a lack of peace, right? Did you have any other thoughts here around like absence of bad stuff?
Yeah, so I thought like maybe a parallel to this would be like the difference between a ceasefire and a peace treaty. So, you know, because we're trying to draw in like the big and the small, right? So one of the things that I learned in recent years, or like the last year or two because of the Ukraine war and stuff, is the idea of a frozen conflict. So I don't know if you've heard of this before, but it's basically all these little wars around the world, and they never end because just the shooting stops. So there's an absence of bad stuff, and both sides stop bombing each other for, you know, one reason or another. But there's never a peace talk followed by a peace treaty and then an agreement, right? So, so they're talking about Ukraine spiraling into a frozen conflict because it seems like both, at least at this current moment, it seems like both sides are at an impasse, and You know, like, it's not like either of them are coming back to the peace table to work out a treaty or whatever, right? So every now and then, like, more firing will start. And so I feel like what you just talked about is, like, the absence of bad stuff, like, in my life personally is not...
It's a temporary ceasefire.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mm. And I think the way it applies is, I think too often when you are disordered and when I am in strife as an individual, my mentality is, I just want to make the bad stuff go away. I just want, and so I'll escape, play some video games for a while, or go out day trip, take a, you know, spa trip, take a couple of mental health days off, or I'll get some medication, right? But those are, but you know, there are absence of bad stuff strategies, but that doesn't necessarily mean it brings in the presence of good stuff, like true contentment, satisfaction with my life, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah,
okay, well, that was gonna be my next point, right? So peace can also be the presence of good stuff, you know. So you know, maybe not just kind of like distracted by video games or medication, right? But like actual you know, good stuff, like, you know, true satisfaction, happiness, fulfillment, contentment, right? You know, a few kind of personal examples, I guess, you know, trying to kind of brainstorm some things is like, I think going for a bushwalk, right? And kind of just like soaking in like all the sights and sounds and the smells, right? Of the bush is really nice. Annoying when sort of like an airplane flies overhead, like these man-made noises that kind of disturb the peace, right? But, you know, during those moments, it's really great. Or is, you know, you're just lying on the grass in the sun on a lazy afternoon, you know, maybe you're listening to some music or a podcast, or you're reading a book, right? But just like, and for me, just on a personal level, like, you know, when I'm playing with the kids or just watching them at the playground, right?
Yeah.
And they're having a good time, and, you know, it's quite like nice and fulfilling, like in that moment, right? It's just kind of like a kind of peaceful time for me.
Yeah, I guess I can relate to that last one. Like the moments of like, okay, I've got my baby in my lap, and then my son crawls up and wants to sit next to me on my other leg, and then my daughter, my eldest, comes up and she tries to make the baby laugh, make Naomi laugh and stuff. And it's like, at that moment, I stop and I step outside of myself for a second, and I look at myself and my surroundings, and I'm like, this is nice, this is peace. But it won't last, right? It's it's a temporary ceasefire, because 2 seconds later, like, the two elder ones are going to be at it or whatever. But Yeah. Like, I to your point, like, presence of good stuff, like things that fill you with joy and life and vitality.
Yes. Yep. Another one, which is like more literal, right? Which is basically like a state of being that is like tranquil or calm, right? And, you know, kind of going back to the kids example, is like not being disturbed by kids, you know, just not being disturbed, right? It's like, if I'm in the office and I just need, you know, concentrate on something, right? And I know, you know, to the best extent possible that the kids are not going to bother me, or my wife is going to try to ensure that, right? And, you know, and that's good, you know, and like, I'm having a peaceful moment, right? Or, you know, going back to the technology discussion, is not having a device around, right? And not having the notifications and the beeps and the boops and the distractions, right? Like, I think that's also being at peace, you know, when you are kind of in the moment, you know, you might be by yourself, right? Just doing something, and yeah, you're sort of at peace right there and then.
Yeah, and sorry to say something a little bit spicy, but I think, you know, peace being a state of tranquility or calm, a lot of medications are focused on producing tranquility or calm, but maybe we recognize that that's still not enough. Like, there's still something missing. Like, for true
or medication or like recreational drugs, right?
Yeah,
stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So I think, like, you know, calm is essential for peace, but not sufficient, maybe.
Yes. Well, okay, so here's a question for you, right? And something that I've been thinking of with all these you know, definitions so far, which is, you know, they're all sort of like temporary. You mentioned like a ceasefire sort of way, right? You sort of, you can have it in one moment and not the next. So I guess the question is, can we be at peace even if we are experiencing distress or suffering, or, you know, if our external circumstances are really bad, right? And we don't have calm or satisfaction in the moment, right? Is it wrong to say, or is it inaccurate to say that we can still be at peace? What do you reckon?
Yeah, great question. I think I I want to automatically answer yes. I'm instinctively.
As a Christian pastor.
Yeah, you're, right? You're answering, I mean, yes. Just even like in general, like there's the idea of someone who's unbothered by the world, who has inner peace. Like the idea of inner peace itself seems to suggest that no matter what's going on outside of me, there's a state that I can achieve in which I'm unmoved or unaffected or undisturbed by the worst sufferings or by the worst tragedies and whatever, right? So I kind of want to say yes, but and maybe like a parallel, like an example of that is, you know, in Christianity we talk about the difference between happiness and joy. So happiness is like like when something outside of you makes you happy, like, oh, someone just handed me a plate of ribs, I'm so happy. But joy is like something that you can't that can't be taken away from you, like, oh, you know, someone slapped me in the face, but I still have joy. Like, you know what I mean? Like, so maybe that's the same with peace.
Okay, so the concept that I want to get to, right, which, you know, we'll also kind of expand on later, is this idea of shalom, right? And that's a Hebrew word, right? But, you know, it's kind of got sort of these roots that also are in other languages. But this idea of like, okay, so it can be translated directly as peace, right? But it's not just that, right? It's kind of like got this deeper sort of existential kind of religious idea to it, right? So not just kind of like peace amongst, you know, different parties, you know, with enemies or peace with God, right? But actually this kind of like wholeness, right? Of rest, of flourishing, right? Basically like experiencing creation, right? And our created world the way that it ought to be, right? And it, in other languages, it's like, you know, it was worth it. It was paid for, right? Perfect, whole. So I guess the TLDR for me, right, kind of getting to that deeper meaning of what peace is that is when things are the way that it should be, right? So like mind, body and soul, you know, our relationships, even like at a societal level, right, is things are the way that it should be. And it's hard because like we can see how things are not, you know, which we'll get to, right?
So I think that's, you're right, like that's the central concept of it. And for me, shout out to any Radiohead fans, like the key phrase is everything in its right place, right? Which I think there's an irony because if you've ever heard that track by Radiohead, it's like the title track to one of their albums, I forget which one.
Kid A, I think.
No, the one after that. Oh man, this is gonna kill me.
Okay.
This is embarrassing. We should both know this. Anyway, so it's a very disturbing, unsettling track, but the lyrics are literally just everything in its right place. And that's what shalom is. It's the idea that in order to have shalom, you have to presuppose that there's such thing as order. Order in the self, order in society, order in the whole world, right? And if you accept that, then peace is a simple definition. It's just everything in its right place according to the right order.
Okay, so Dan, you had a recent epiphany, right, when preparing this show about what is the origin of disorder. So can you tell us about that?
Okay, so I had this thought. It's like like you said, it's a bit of an epiphany, right? So this is something I was thinking about. This came out of a Bible study I was writing on Genesis 3, which was like the chapter where sin enters the world and stuff, right? And the question that I was thinking about is, where does evil come from? Or another way to phrase it in the theme of our episode is, what is the obstacle to peace? What's stopping us from achieving peace? And there's this sort of generalization where the liberal left, the political left and the political right answer that question differently, and fundamentally that's why the two ideologies are so different. So the left says that the obstacle to peace is external, It's our environment that makes us evil, right? And so the roots of this actually come from liberalism, capital L liberalism, as a philosophical movement, right? So the philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, he said his big thing was that human beings are by nature good, but they're corrupted by society. And so a quote that you've probably heard maybe here or there is, he says, "Man is born free, but everywhere is in chains." So it's society that corrupts and makes us, we're innocent, pure babies and stuff. But then, and so the solution then is to, you know, well, this, well, a couple of solutions. One is to reject society. So become like a hippie romantic, be free from society, return to nature. Or you could do the opposite. You could actually lean harder into society and you could take the technocratic path. So technology plus government, right? So lean harder into social engineering and give more power to the state to enact peace through distributing wealth and creating laws, right? So that's the left. And the key is that the obstacle to peace is outside of us. It's our environment. So the opposite then, the right, the political right says that the obstacle to peace is actually internal. So if you want to know why there's no peace in the world, look at yourself. Look at the mirror. It's our evil hearts that makes us evil. And you can see there's an obvious Christian influence here, right? Because, you know, the whole idea of sin, like the most basic concept of it is that we're evil, right? So, you know, you have Bible verses like Proverbs 4:23, "Above all else, guard your heart, for it's the wellspring of life." You've got that famous one, Romans chapter 3, "There is no one righteous, not even one." And so the right would say that the decline of society is due to the corruption of individuals and the institutions that have failed to turn out moral individuals that make up society. So then if you are right, like if you are a conservative right, you would say then the solution is moral formation. So the right wants to use the state's power to produce moral individuals. And that's why we got to have these rules about abortion. And so we got to have these rules about, you know, homosexuality. And so we got to, everything that the right, everything on the right's agenda is to try to make moral people, because that's the secret to having peace, to having an ordered, moral, peaceful society.
Right. So then, okay. So starting from, again, the left formulation, right? So you kind of apply that to what we're talking about today. So there's there's absence of peace, right? There's disorder, there's anxiety and that kind of stuff. So then I guess the left prescription for that is kind of like, more programs, you know, we need more counselors, we need more education, we need more government funding, right, to do stuff that will then help people, right, deal with the anxiety and the absence of peace, right? I mean, you know, it's a simplification, but essentially, like, that's the left's prescription, right?
Yeah.
And what were the right, like, because I was having a bit of trouble, like, thinking about what is the right prescription, because, you know, if the left is like, it's about society, systems, structures, right? And the right is about kind of personal, individual responsibility. Like, what does that look like?
Yeah. So I guess the right would want to try to attack the problem at the root. And if they believe that it's moral individuals that create a peaceful society, then you want to start with people, right? So the thing I think of is like maybe what would you call it? Like maybe like masculinity culture or that thing. All right. The key person I had in mind was Jordan Peterson.
Of course.
I mean, mind you, it's a little bit dated because he's gone through some rough times and everything, right? But it, like a few years, what, like we say 5-7 years ago, he was like this super influential leader, especially for young men. And his whole shtick, like his whole theme was that if you are suffering, then you've got to deal with it. So if you're anxious, then the answer is for you to acknowledge your agency, to accept your responsibility, and to do something about it, to take action, right? And so his big thing was, like, the reason why he was such a hero for young men was because he was this guy, like, all of a sudden, like, being a father figure to, like, to, like, millions of men who just needed somebody to say, hey, be a man, do this, do right, like, you know, like, get a job and be responsible and stuff. And point is, it's all about the individual. So if you're anxious, then what can you do about it? The problem is within the self, and therefore it's up to the self to resolve it. All right, so I think that's one thread. Like, and obviously Jordan Peterson is a very right leaning sort of kind of character. Yeah.
Okay, so then your epiphany, right, is that this kind of left-right dynamic has changed, right, or is different now?
Well, okay, so here's the thing, and cards on the table. I don't think I even told you this before, right?
Yeah.
I've had this. I've been sitting on this epiphany for like 5 years, like, because like I wrote that Bible study like ages ago, like, and I was looking for like the perfect opportunity to talk about it, either in a sermon or whatever, but it just never came. And the problem is,
you could never shoehorn it into a sermon.
I could never shoehorn it in. And now the problem is, everything that I just said in the last 5 minutes is completely is irrelevant. It's out of date now.
It's dated.
And the reason is because, like, that was probably a more accurate description of left and right ideology in the early 2000s. But like the 2010s have seen like this real bad de-evolution of the political axis. And I think what we're seeing now is, I you know, the term tribalism has been thrown around a whole ton ever since, you know, like mid 2010s and stuff. And it's this idea that it's my side versus your side, right? And I think that that's now the dominant definition of good and evil, of chaos and peace, at least in politics. So good and peaceful is my side, and evil and chaotic is everyone that disagrees with me. And this is true whether you identify with the left or the right. So essentially, it's a return to a very simplistic, like, think like, you know, like Disney fairy tale, Sleeping Beauty, like good versus evil. I'm the good prince and you're the evil dragon that I must slay. And, you know, like, this goes all the way back through a lot of human history to... And
So there's like there's an in-group and there's an out-group, right? And I guess like for our purposes, you know, like we've talked in previous podcasts about, you know, like identity politics, right? And that kind of thing, you know, where there's kind of like a victim oppressor sort of dynamic, right? And if you belong to certain classes of race and gender and, you know, kind of people groups, right, you are either privileged, you know, and need to be kind of taken down a notch, right? Or you are sort of historical victims and you deserve like special treatment and consideration, right? But that's kind of like the dynamic of like pitting one group of people against another group of people.
That's right. And actually, once again, this I'm taking inspiration from Jonathan Haidt in his book Coddling of the American Mind. He talks about this victim-oppressor mindset, but the interesting thing he says is that you could talk about this like identity politics, and what he says is we've moved from common human identity politics to common enemy identity politics. And what he means by that is you could talk about us being all part of the human race, and that's why we need to do better, and building unity, right? So the example he gives is Martin Luther King. He says we need to overcome racial oppression and the civil rights movement. His message was built on the idea that we are all common humans with each other, right? But now we've moved away from that, and there's no more Martin Luther Kings in the world anymore because now it's all about common enemies. So we are the way that you inspire and rally people in the social marketplace is by using hatred and rage, by stoking stoking bitterness and resentment and saying, you got to get up and vote and you got to go and do this and stand up for this or that, because if you don't, they're going to come for you and they're going to, you know? And so we're no longer a common human trying to build a better world together, but we're a common enemy trying to build a better world for me and my side only at the expense of everyone else who's not in my tribe.
So I think we've, talked about the identity politics and all that aspect of it, right? And I was kind of just reflecting on the implications, you know, of what used to be the left-right dynamic, right? Now kind of overtaken by the common enemy kind of dynamic. And then what does it mean? Again, you know, kind of going back to this idea of the big and the small scope, right? And how these kind of big changes in the way that the left and right operate, you know, and how identity politics have, you know, kind of affected society, right, has an effect on the individual level, you know. And I think for us as individuals, we're sort of like being affected both like too little and too much by the external. Okay, so what I mean by that is we're being affected too little in that, like, one message that we hear, right, is the whole kind of the Disney sort of idea is we need to look inside of ourselves, right? We get to define who we are, you know, like all this kind of previous freedom episodes that we've done, right? Our feelings and desires are what defines us, you know? So let's not get too hung up on family, tradition, institutions, right? The way that things have been done, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so that's the messaging. And so as a result, right, the consequence then is, okay, then we should be able to think and feel and do, you know, however we want, do whatever we want, right? Everything's permitted. But then there is that aspect of, like, the confusion and the enemy, right? Because, well, it's this paradox of choice where there's just too much. Like, what do we even do with myself, right?
Yeah.
And then in order to... And the whole thing is, like, the nature abhors a vacuum, right? Like, we can't just have, like, have nothing, you know, and sort of make our... build a life on that, right?
Yeah.
It's like nothing and everything, right? So therefore, people will then look to find their meaning and purpose in something, you know? And I guess from a Christian perspective, this whole idea of, like, the God-shaped whole, right? Like, what is the thing that we're seeking, right, to give us meaning and purpose in life, you know? And then people find it in various things like money and beauty and fame and politics, right? And I think there's a longer conversation to be had about, like, mysticism, you know? So, like, like, religions are making a comeback, right? But not just the old religions, but, like, new religions, you know? Like, UFOs and psychedelics and, you know, like, what's happening with AI. It's kind of like a mystery box, right? That can actually, you know, is a portending something, you know, way beyond kind of the human realm, right?
Yeah.
But so that aspect of, like, looking kind of inside, like, taking too little account of the external. But on the other hand, we also kind of take too much, you know? We're sort of, like, looking around, we see all the bad stuff out there, right? The whole kind of enemies idea, you know? Like, things are getting worse, and it's so-and-so's fault, right? Like, we find the scapegoats, which is, like, the opposite political party, right? It's the out-group, it's the people who are not like us, you know? And we sort of, like, think in these kind of over-generalizations, right, about people groups. And that's when we get into the whole sort of polarization, right, partisan politics and identity politics and so forth, right, which is actually, you know, it is a bit sort of scary, right, when we look around at kind of at least the Western world these days, right, the countries are kind of like either sort of like becoming kind of scarily right wing, right, or left wing, you know, and I guess for me it's like, well, there are ways that we can deal with this, right, at the individual level, you know? It's like, okay, let's not sort of think about people in just broad people groups, right? And, you know, in stereotypes and, you know, think poorly of... because, you know, that's the basis of, like, racism and anti-Semitism and all that kind of stuff, right? It's kind of like, yeah, it's that kind of deep-rooted prejudice, right, that we need to fight against. Or it's like, okay... we need to be, like, you know, practicing gratitude, and we need to kind of care for others, right? So, like, those are all kind of, like, individual things, right, that we can talk about, but, you know, but I guess for the purpose of this episode, right, that's not what I want to focus on, because, yeah, like, how do we get peace, right? Is peace, achieving peace, just about doing these things right at a personal level, like self-improvement style, right, to get there, right, I feel like it's not sufficient, right? So I'm kind of like, you know, giving you the ball to hit there, Dan, but like setting you up, but like, you know, again, going back to that deeper meaning of shalom, right, of peace, like how can we actually get there?
Yeah. Okay. So I appreciate you teeing me up, but I'm just extra aware that we're only a few days removed from Christmas. So I feel like a lot of our listeners probably have spent the last couple of weeks hearing Jesus is the answer. Jesus can give you peace, you know, peace on earth and mercy mild. And God, and so I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm trying to work out, how do I get to Jesus without sounding trite and cliched? Just, you know, trying to be real here. But okay, how about this? All right. We started off this episode talking about like big things, big picture things, things that are happening in the world beyond our control. And now we've come down and we've drilled down to this question of where can we find peace? What's the upshot? Like, what are we going to do about it? What's the takeaway? Or as Christians love to say, what's the application point here, right? So borrowing again that sort of left-right ideological distinction, so maybe one solution is the right one, as in capital R, right? So fix society with one righteous shalom individual at a time. The secret to peace is to be an agent of peace yourself, and to you know, try to create a society that produces peacemakers rather than chaos makers or whatever. But you know, that's has that worked so far? And then another solution might be the left one, the capital L left one. So grand sweeping policy, cultural, social changes. So maybe if the state takes an active control of society and dispenses its resources here and there where education is needed, where social help is needed and stuff like that, then we can achieve peace, right? But I want to say, it kind of feels like both solutions are going to fall short because both of them still include the weak link, and that is, well, humans, human nature, because we can't escape who we are fundamentally. And fundamentally, if we are creatures of destruction, then how are we supposed to produce peace out of it? And as an example, look at Israel-Palestine, right? That's been on everyone's mind and hearts the end of this year. I feel like if you look at it as objectively as possible and you look at both sides and you try to avoid that whole taking sides thing where one side is right, the other side is wrong, you'd probably come to the conclusion that everyone is acting rationally according to the circumstances that they're presented with. And yet, with these circumstances, all we get is endless war, tit for tat. We get ceasefires, but no real peace treaty. We get, you know, temporary ceasefires, but no real lasting cessation of violence. And to me, that kind of says that what we need is not actually a policy or a new method or really anything that is in our power as human beings. What we need is an external savior. We need outside intervention because we can't solve it ourselves. I don't know, what do you think? Like, is that a bit trite? Or is that a cop out?
No, I think, well, as a friend, I guess, you know, as someone,
tell me what I want to hear.
No, I don't think it is. I think it all makes sense, right? It is, you know, from both a wouldn't it be great if this was true, right? As well as a yes, this makes sense that it would be this way, right? That, you know, if like human nature is such that, you know, we will inevitably fall short, right? And we will sort of like wage war against a neighbor and that kind of stuff, right? Then, yeah, like there is no long-lasting peace, right? Aside from ceasefires, there's no long-lasting shalom, but for an external intervention, right, of a divine nature.
Look, I'll tell you why I think it's trite. And I want you to know, I've spent some time thinking about this because the last thing I want to do is sound trite from the pulpit, right? I think the reason why saying Jesus brings you peace is cliched and not helpful is because I put myself in the shoes of someone who rocks up to church looking for peace, looking for answers. And then I hear a preacher say, accept Jesus and he'll give you peace. And it's like, so what? Bombs are still raining down in Ukraine. So what? I go home and my dad is still beating my mom. So what? I still take medications for anxiety and I still have this and that and bullying still happens in school. And what's changed? How's it? Yeah. Like, and I feel like that's where even I got to be honest, I feel like I'd be loath for someone to walk out of a church door feeling that way, right? And so what if we go back to the idea of shalom again, okay? So we said shalom is a concept of peace that talks about everything in its right place, okay? The world going from disorder to order. So if that's the case, maybe peace is about finding the right perspective or context for your experience of the world and not trying to deny or erase it. Not trying to look away and wash over the ugliness and filthiness of the chaotic world we live in, but finding a hopeful context out of that, right? And so, how about this, okay? So, in Christianity, the broad, and I think we've touched upon this here or there in previous episodes, there's a grand narrative that sort of defines all of history, okay? So this narrative can be told through four broad movements. So the first movement is creation. God created the world. And in the first movement, you had shalom. This is the Genesis 1 chapter, the Genesis 1 movement. You had order. You had everything in its right place. But unfortunately, that didn't last long because two chapters later, you had the second movement, which is sin. Which is disorder, which is evil, which is sadness, which is tears, which is violence. The first murder takes place in Genesis chapter 4.
Humanity's rebellion against God, right?
Absolutely.
And the consequences of that, yep.
That's right. And actually, yeah, that's the summary of the second movement. Humanity rebels against God. The very first disordering was the disordering of humans as obeyers of God's law, of God, of listeners and obeyers of God. We flip that, and like a Jenga tower coming down, like we remove that central piece, and then everything else got tossed into chaos and disarray, right? But then movement number three comes along, and that's the Jesus movement. We call that redemption, right? So that's the start of the New Testament. Jesus comes into the world, and that's what we celebrate in Christmas. Light enters the darkness. An external savior comes in, outside intervention comes into our hopeless, dark world of cruelty and turmoil and does something about it. But ironically, the thing that he does is he doesn't institute peace right away. He actually lets chaos defeat him. Or so it seems, because that's what the cross is about. He dies. He dies to evil, to the chaos of the world. But he doesn't stay dead. He doesn't let it defeat him. He rises triumphant. On the third day, he was raised again. And now death no longer has its sting, and evil has been defeated. Now, here's the part that's relevant to what we're talking about. So we're talking about trying to make sense of the chaos around our world. So I think the key is that what Jesus did when he died and rose again was he effected the beginning of restoration, of reordering of the world, of peace. But it's not done yet. It's not been completed. And we live in this time period. We currently live in the third movement of this four-movement narrative. We live in a time period where chaos still exists and violence and conflict still arises, even though all the forces of evil have already been dealt a decisive blow. So in Christian lingo, this is called the now but not yet. Salvation has happened now, but not yet, not fully. It hasn't been completed. Another way to describe it is the overlap of the ages. We live in between. We live in at the end of one age, the age of disorder and chaos, and at the beginning of another age, the age of restoration and eternity, right? Eternal life and all that stuff. But because it's overlapped, your experience of the world, you experience both. So as a Christian, you can experience peace because you know you have been saved. And by faith, your salvation is secure for you. But bombs are still raining down in Ukraine. Israel and Hamas are still at it. And I still have anxiety and depression and my family life is no good and all that kind of thing, right? So what this does is it makes sense of what's happening now, and it gives me a credible reason for why this world sucks and sometimes my life sucks. But it doesn't leave me with just a reason. It gives me a hope. It says that because Jesus has already dealt a decisive blow to everything bad, this won't always be the case. It's just that history is not finished yet. The story is not completed yet. But we are heading towards peace. The trajectory of the world bends, heads towards peace.
Yeah. And it's about a change in perspective, right? So not just looking at your own life or the Middle East or what you read on the news, right? But actually taking a cosmic and an eternal perspective, right?
That's right. And so it's like, you know, we kind of hinted at like maybe a solution to peace, to like conflict or the lack of peace in my heart is to stop looking outside, stop looking at all the bad news, stop doom scrolling and just focus on yourself, tend your garden as it were, right? But it's kind of paradoxically the opposite of that. So we're looking at the whole world. We started with like technological, geopolitical, and all these big picture things of why there's chaos. And I'm telling you, don't just look at the whole world. Look even farther. Look at the cosmos. Look at the polar ends of eternity and where everything is headed. And you'll see that this current moment of strife and discomfort is like sense is made of it when we look at where we're headed, right? And so I guess what I'm trying to say is because I want to leave our listeners with something like actually positive to take away from this, right? What I've noticed is instinctively in a lot of my preaching, I've been getting on and on more harder about mission, Christian mission. So traditionally, mission is about evangelism, right? It's about preaching Jesus to, you know, lost people and like making more disciples and making more and converting people, right? And yeah, absolutely, it is that because Jesus told us to do that. God gave us that mission to do as Christians. But I actually think that mission is also the solution to lack of peace for the Christian because this mission is what gives us purpose. It's our purpose amidst the strife. I have purpose in suffering right now. I have, as much as 2023 like kicked the crap out of me, I'm okay with it. I embrace it because every moment of every day I have been working towards what God has promised or doing my best to, you know.
And as much as 2023 is portending great turmoil to come, right, on different dimensions,
that's right,
that like yeah.
Like, what kind of global turmoil, economic turmoil, geopolitical, technological turmoil can trump the Son of God rising from the dead to ultimately defeat Satan and the forces of darkness? And I think that's that fact, that perspective is the answer to peace, is the answer to is where can we find peace, right? So to segue into my Dan's summary, absolutely. We are in a pivotal moment. Things feel like they're spinning out of control. But in the grand context of history, of redemptive history, not much has really changed, right? And I want to say that out of this chaos, opportunities are arising, missional opportunities, opportunities for us to look at the crap in the world and get to work, you know? And you've said once or twice in this episode already, Chong, that religions are making a comeback. So spirituality is being renewed in the West, and people are so fed up and sick of the old institutions that they're finally willing to give church another try, right? So that's there's research showing that there are people who are just walking into church, and I think the beautiful thing about this is we're no longer a Christian society, we're a post-Christian society, which means that the average person who didn't grow up Christian will no longer be familiar with the ancient Christian stories and traditions. They won't know that Jesus was born of the Virgin Mary or that he was born in a manger. You know, they won't know that he turned water to wine or that he walked on water or, you know, like, and you know, we have people walking into churches who want to hear the Christian story, but with new innocent baby eyes and baby ears, and they're willing to give us a shot. Like, how can you not be excited about this? So like, we might be in a world war a year from now. we might bomb ourselves out of any hope of material prosperity or wealth. We might the AI uprising, whatever. Like, I don't care. Like, I still have purpose. It's not going to change fundamentally why I'm here and what I'm doing here. I am ordered in this world that I dwell in, and that is where peace comes from. And I think that's all I've got to say about that.
Great. Thanks, Dan, for that rousing final speech. We come to the end of this episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening. It's good to be back again. If you want to connect with us, we are on Instagram, and we're on what formerly used to be Twitter, now X, at InGoodFaithFM. You can also email us at ingoodfaithmail@gmail.com. And if you like what you heard, please tell a friend. It'd be great to build up a community of listeners who engage issues and ideas, big ideas, in a fast-changing world, in good faith. And if you've loved what you heard, you can also support us by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts. Search for In Good Faith, and when you find us, scroll down to ratings and reviews, top 5 stars, and maybe leave us some kind words. We'd really appreciate it. All right, Dan, until 2024... I will talk to you.
Take care. It's good to be back, Chong. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Bye-bye.
See ya.